We're in Daniel chapter 2, as I said. One of the things we'll be talking about today is speaking truth to power. And that, of course, is a main theme throughout the book of Daniel, speaking truth to power. There are a couple reasons, main reasons, that I was able to think of why speaking truth to power is difficult. One, it can be hard to speak truth to power for fear of losing something that is precious to you, like your life, in the instance of Daniel. But, you know, we can all have a hard time speaking truth to power in our various jobs, and, you know, there can be consequences for speaking truth. It isn't always just, people aren't always really glad to hear the truth that you are sharing with them. So that's one reason. A second reason it can be hard to speak truth to power is because you want to ingratiate yourself with the powers that be, or you want them to like you, or, you know, there's a sense of wanting to be one of them, or be... to be well-liked and cared for and all that sort of thing. There was a great example I saw of this online. Someone uploaded a YouTube video that I thought was thought-provoking and funny, which is that one of the reasons, this gentleman's contention in his YouTube video is one of the reasons that our celebrities do such insane things, one of the reasons, there's probably many, but is that people don't tell them that they're doing insane things the same way we would, you know, if Nancy was doing something nuts, I would just tell Nancy, that's crazy, you need to stop that. But because they're so famous and everybody wants to like them and be close to them and everything, that they don't get challenged. And he showed a couple of clips from interviews. In this instance, it was Alicia Silverstone, whichever, you know, the famous actress, who has decided that one of the good ways, a good way to feed her child is to chew up the food and spit it into her child's mouth. She thought that was wise, and, you know, I'm sure it's not hurting the child, but it's just, if a friend of mine was doing that, I would say, Caleb, maybe you shouldn't pre-chew your food and spit it into your child's mouth. It's probably not necessary, and it's sort of sickening. But in the interviews, and they had a couple of clips of this, of interviewer saying, so I hear that you do this, and Alicia Silverstone saying, oh yes, it's great, I just felt instinctually that I needed to spit my food into my child's mouth. And then the interviewer, instead of saying, like people would do, you're nuts, you need help, or that's gross, they'd be like, oh, so you're starting a conversation about what it means to feed your child, or that's very brave of you to say, you know, that sort of affirming positive things, because, you know, it's Alicia Silverstone, you've got an interview with her and you want to be affirming and positive. Anyway, there were other examples of this, and I thought, you know, it's very true that probably after a while you get very insulated as a celebrity, that everything you do is just sort of normal, and it's hard to have the touchstones of what's considered, you know, normal human behavior. Anyway, I thought that was funny. I love YouTube. It's great for sermons. So anyway, back to Daniel. Now, you know, Middle Eastern kings, you know, you may or may not, if you were alive back then under Nebuchadnezzar, you may or may not idolize him. You may or may not want to ingratiate yourself with him. Many would. But at the very least, everybody fears him. It's hard to speak truth to Nebuchadnezzar for fear, regardless of whatever else you may feel about him personally. So it was hard to speak truth to power, and continues to be so to this day in many ways. I find it difficult. So with that in mind, let's start with the passage. Laura, if you want to put the first... is the PowerPoint file up? Take a second. You need some help? Let me help. You got to close that out. Yeah, once you close it, then you can reopen the. There it is. And then. Okay, thanks. Laura's standing in for our absent Jay. Who I don't blame for not being here. Yes, thank you, yes. I'm sure Jay looked out his window and looked at his bike and looked out the window and looked at his bike and said, not today. let's go ahead and read this. In the second year of his reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. His mind was troubled, and he could not sleep. So the king summoned the magicians, enchanters, sorcerers, and astrologers to tell him what he had dreamed. When they came in and stood before the king, he had said to them, I have had a dream that troubles me, and I want to know what it means. So the astrologers answered the king, and start with a little bit of, you know, buttering him up. May the king live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will interpret it. Highly confident. And the king replied to the astrologers, this is what I have firmly decided. If you do not tell me what my dream was and interpret it, I will have you cut into pieces and your houses turned into piles of rubble. But if you tell me the dream and explain it, you will receive from me gifts and rewards and great honor. So tell me the dream and interpret it for me. So he's taking the biggest stick, you know, that he can find. I will kill you and your families, is what that means, to turn your houses into piles of rubble. I'll kill you and your families. But if, or alternatively, if you do this, I will give you the greatest honor. So he's, this means a lot to Nebuchadnezzar. So tell me the dream and interpret it for me. And once more they replied, let the king tell his servants the dream and we will interpret it. Notice they're no longer saying, may the king live forever. But they're not really wishing that anymore. So as a point of interest here, in verse 4, thanks, where it says, then the astrologers answered the king, may the king live forever. Right there where it says, may the king live forever, that's where the book of Daniel switches into Aramaic. It's been Hebrew up to this point. It switches to Aramaic, and then at the end of chapter 7, verse 28, the Aramaic ends, and it switches back to Hebrew, which is intriguing, right? And there must be a reason for it. I don't know what the reason is for it. There are many theories, one of which is undoubtedly true, but I'm not going to preach them because I'm not sure which is true. It doesn't really matter for our purposes. But it is kind of interesting, right there at that point in the quote from the astrologers, that it switches to a different language and then switches back. And you can read Wikipedia or read about it or Google it, and there's really interesting discussions about it, but I can't say with any certainty why that is. So that's just an aside. So back to the story. So this seems to be, I hope you can feel from the intensity of Nebuchadnezzar, that this is more than just capricious cruelty on his part. This is more than him just being sadistic. He really wants to know what this dream means. This is troubling him deeply. Whatever his other qualities, Nebuchadnezzar, it's clear he's an intelligent man. He was known to be an intelligent ruler and crafty and all that sort of thing. And he knows, or seems to know, that his subjects, his various magicians and astrologers and priests, will come up with an interpretation of his dream. He seems to know that they will do that. But he also knows that it probably won't be true, or it may not be true, that they'll just tell him what he wants to hear. Again, it's sort of the Alicia Silverstone thing. Like, he doesn't want to hear just what they want to tell him. Or, I got lost in that sentence, but I think you understand my point. They will just invent something if it comes to it. They can't think of anything. And he doesn't want that. He's clearly deeply troubled by this dream. He's looking for truth. This is always an opening in God's world when someone is looking for something true and they're not content with just easy answers or something that just makes them feel good about themselves or whatever. That's a moment where God can work, when someone just wants to know the truth, come hell or high water. And it's interesting here that he displays such a lack of faith in his own intelligentsia, in his own religious professionals, if you will. He's not really trusting these guys. He wants a display of real power. He wants to know the truth of his dream. And, you know, it's cruel and barbaric, but you have to admit, it's kind of clever. Tell me the dream and then interpret it. That's smart. And, you know, in a way, I wondered, and I don't know if this is true necessarily, but I did wonder about it quite a bit when I was working on the sermon. I wonder if Nebuchadnezzar may be testing his own faith, maybe testing his belief in the gods. Because these are, after all, these men, I presume they were mostly men, they were the elite. They were those who were to be closest to the gods, if you will. And I wonder if he was thinking to himself, is my faith real? Can I trust this? Can I lean on this? Can I trust the gods of Babylon and believe those who claim to speak for the god of Babylon, the gods of Babylon? He seems absolutely certain that his dream has significance. It hasn't occurred to him, or doesn't seem to be part of his... He's not asking him, is this a significant dream or not? He's certain that this dream is significant. And it scares him and unnerves him on some deep spiritual level such that he can't even sleep. So he needs spiritual help and counsel, and it needs to not be contrived. So let's go, let's continue on here. The king answered, I know with certainty that you are trying to gain time. Of course he does, he's not an idiot. Because you see, I firmly decreed, if you do not tell me the dream, there is but one verdict for you. You have agreed to speak lying and misleading words to me until things take a turn. So he's basically saying to them, I know that you're false, that I know that you're capable anyway of being false, and that all you want to do is please me. Therefore, tell me the dream, and I shall know that you can give me its interpretation. So he doubles down on that. And the Chaldeans answered the king. Chaldeans is, well, in essence, it's another synonym for Babylonians. Chaldeans answered the king, there's no one on earth who can reveal what the king demands. In fact, no king. And here they kind of chastise him. They're like, wait a minute, you've overstepped your bounds here. That's how desperate these guys are. No king, however great or powerful, has ever asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or Chaldean. The thing that the king is asking is too difficult. No one can reveal it to the king except the gods, whose dwelling is not with mortals. So they even put, they say, well, you know, the gods could do this, but they hastened, these are the professionals who are supposed to be able to speak to the gods. They hasten to add, and the gods aren't here, by the way. So only gods can do this. They're not here. So the message they're telling Nebuchadnezzar is that the gods don't really care. They either don't care or they don't see your plight. They're not here. They're just, don't bother the gods. And this reveals a truth that I think sometimes it's easy for us to overlook as Christians in this time and place, that the pagan world really was genuinely, and you can read in ancient philosophers and texts of days gone by, that the pagan world really was a lonely one, existentially speaking. It was a lonely world. The gods existed in a realm that was completely separate from the realm that we live in here on earth. And the gods had little love for human beings, usually. Gods could come to love a human being, maybe. In fact, there are fables and stories about that from the Greek and Roman Empire. But as a whole, gods did not love human beings, and they were separate from them. They could be enticed, if you will, to come and live within an idol. That's the point of the pagan idols, that if you had an idol that was carefully and beautifully crafted, and you fed it through these sort of ritualistic ways, the god would come and reside within the idol and come alive, as it were. And the reason the gods would do that is not to be close to the humans, but to be fed by the humans, especially in the Babylonian Empire. That was the whole point. In fact, that's why humans are made. In the Babylonian creation myth, the god Kinju is destroyed by Marduk. And then humans are made out of the blood of Kinju. And the reason they made humans was to feed the gods, just to work for them. Basically, just slave labor, in essence, is what we are in the Babylonian world. So, anyway, that's the background of a very skeletal background of the Babylonian belief system. So when the assembled religious elite tell Nebuchadnezzar that the gods do not live among human beings, and that what they are tacitly admitting is that their inability to communicate with the gods, that we just, they're out there, we're here, we can't do this thing. And subsequently, they cannot interpret Nebuchadnezzar's dream. You know, it's an interesting thought, the pagan world is so ancient and so old, and one of the if you watched, as I have, a lot of debates between atheists and Christians online, one of the accusations that's made against people of faith is that, you know, people invent God or gods for comfort and for whatever, just to kind of have a teddy bear in the sky kind of thing. And that would have come as real news to the pagan world, for whom the gods were anything but a comfort. In fact, something that could cause great distress is if a god started paying close attention to you. That was not always a good thing. It was often a bad thing. And there was a tremendous anxiety within the human world about the gods, such that we humans would start killing each other on the basis to relieve that anxiety. And that's the basis of human sacrifice. Known in the Edomite Empire and even in the Israelite Empire at their lowest point, closer to home, the Aztec Empire, many pagan, since the gods aren't good and they're not loving, the best thing to do is appease them. And, you know, the greatest sacrifice you can give to a god is a human life. So, you know, this notion that we invented the gods to be comforts to us and to be, you know, sort of is sort of a modern conceit of what faith has meant historically for people. So I just thought that was interesting. Yeah. That's an aside. It was lonely to be a pagan. And furthermore, for the Babylonians, there was no hope of heaven. And you just went down to Sheol, which Sheol being a dark, not scary, but lonely place where you go hungry for all eternity. And everybody goes. It's not a question whether you're good or bad or anything like that. You just go to Sheol, and that's it. You're done. So there's not a lot of hope there. It's a pretty bleak existence. So it's something for us to say, or something for us to cling to, not as something that's been true for all eternity, but something that God has revealed to us, that we don't walk in an empty, callous world, that we walk with a God who loves us, and that God sees us, you know, the idea of omnipresence, rather, that God is always present with you. In fact, that God indwells within us. It's not, I mean, that there's things we take for granted sometimes about this God whom we love and know. Just because you have gods or you believe in a certain God does not mean that's a source of comfort and peace to you. I think part of what Nebuchadnezzar just wants to know is, does God see me? Or the gods, or whomever, Marduk probably is the chief pantheon of his gods. Does Marduk see me? You know, one of the great stories in the Bible, or gives me comfort, is the story of Hagar and Ishmael. You might be familiar with it. I won't tell the whole story, but, you know, she is so full of joy and delight just because God sees her. She names this place, you know, the God who sees me. Because, you know, she's driven out. Most of you probably know the story, but she's driven out, and she's, you know, has this son, and God speaks to her through an angel and says, you know, well, actually gives her some bad news about the future of her son and whatnot. It's not all good news by any means, but she's so happy and thrilled that God sees her, that he knows her and is walking with her. Not something to take for granted. But who sees Nebuchadnezzar? Well, his wise men says no one. No God cares for you. Now, Nebuchadnezzar was a murderous Babylonian king. History tells us, the Bible tells us, we know it. He has nothing in common with me, or with any of you, I hope, in terms of his life experience. But he was a human being made in God's image. And every single human being made in God's image, deep down inside, really wants to be loved by God and known by God. That's how we were made. That's the deepest cry of our heart. Nebuchadnezzar, for all whatever he was that as well. That's what he wanted. And when basically his professionals tell him, you know what, you're unknown and you're unloved and the gods don't care and we can't help you, he gets angry. He's hurt, in essence, and angry. And so the next passage, if you can put that up there, sweet. Because of this, the king flew into a violent rage and commanded that all the wise men of Babylon be destroyed. When you've lost all hope, and you've lost all, the only thing you can do is just lash out and try to share your pain. The decree was issued, and the wise men were about to be executed. And they looked for Daniel and his companions to execute them. So you can envision soldiers going throughout the streets. They're going to gather them all up together and kill them. Then Daniel responded with prudence and discretion to Arioch, the king's chief executioner, who had gone out to execute the wise men of Babylon. And he asked Arioch, the royal official, why is the decree of the king so urgent? And Arioch then explained the matter to Daniel. So Daniel went in and requested that the king give him time, and he would tell the king the interpretation. It's not clear if he did that directly in the throne room to the king or with an intermediary, but that's what he did. Now, the conversation with Nebuchadnezzar is not recorded. So we don't know, you know, or the conversation with his royal official, we don't know exactly how that unfolded. But I can tell you one thing for certain, that Daniel put his body and his blood on the line to get that, to be able to extend the lives of all the wise men, or all the, I should say, the religious professionals in the city. Because I'm sure Nebuchadnezzar didn't just say to Daniel, that's fine, take another week, take some more time, you know, you say you can give me the interpretation, I'll give you a few days for it before I kill everybody. I have to believe that there was a special threat given to Daniel because he did get more time, such that if Daniel came back and did not give the interpretation of the dream and its interpretation, that he would undergo something extremely unpleasant. And the Babylonians, as we talked about a little bit in the first chapter of Daniel, but I want to impress upon you again, they were a dark people, very, in terms of being evil, for lack of a better term. They were able to torture people in ways that are just beyond our experience or even understanding now. We can only read about it or see, sometimes in ancient inscriptions you can see about it. But it's important to talk about these things because, my life right now is pretty much littered with children's tales and children's stories, and Daniel in the Lion's Den, of course, is a favorite children's story and whatnot. And I get very, it all seems very lighthearted sometimes. And so it's important to get back into that space and remember what they were capable of doing. The Babylonians were known for their torturous ways. They would remove extremities from people, remove organs from people who disappointed the king. They would flay people alive, which is peeling the skin back slowly until you die. They would impale people. If you want to put up the next slide, this is from the Assyrians, actually. But the Babylonians did this as well, even though this is an Assyrian inscription. This is from the Sennacherib's palace, rather. And it's showing Assyrian soldiers impaling people alive on poles. They were very good at that. They would put the pole through you in such a way that you wouldn't die right away. It would take a long time to die. And the other ones that are a little bit too gross for me to even describe. The reason I'm saying all this is because Daniel put that before the king. I'm sure that if Daniel had just gone with the others and been quiet about it, he would have been executed in a normal, humane, whatever that looked like, a quick fashion. But Daniel went before the king and said, I'll give you an interpretation. And the king gave him more time. I expect there was a cost to be paid for that if he failed. So again, I just want to emphasize the reality of this. This is probably one of the scariest things you could do. Because there's more than just death on the line here. There's torture, which terrible, terrible torture. So these were the real events of history. No child story. In a way, Daniel is standing in the gap. He's shielding the priests of a foreign nation. He's shielding the Babylonian priests, in a way, waiting for God to speak. I mean, his faith and courage are really incredible. So we'll go to the next slide there. And Daniel went to his home, went back home, and informed his companions. Interestingly, he uses his companions' Hebrew names. Remember, they're all given Babylonian names, but they're at home. They've retained their heritage. They've retained who they are. He informed his companions, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, and told them to seek mercy from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that Daniel and his companions, with the rest of the wise men of Babylon, might not perish. And the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision of the night, and Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Let's go ahead and read Daniel's blessing. Daniel said, Blessed be the name of God from age to age, for wisdom and power are his. He changes times and seasons, deposes kings and sets up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and hidden things. He knows what's in the darkness, and light dwells with him. To you, O God of my ancestors, I give thanks and praise, for you have given me wisdom and power, and have now revealed to me what we asked of you, for you have revealed to us what the king ordered. So I just want to take a second and reflect on how Daniel has really invested in his enemies. He's invested in the Babylonians. He doesn't just talk about himself and his friends and, hey, our lives are going to be... He talks about all the wise men of Babylon, how all their lives will be saved. He's not just doing this for selfish reasons. He really cares. And as the book of Daniel unfolds, you'll see that Daniel really does care for these, his people's enemies. People have done horrible things to him personally, as we talked about at length in the first sermon. Daniel is best described, in my opinion, as the anti-Jonah. If you're familiar with Jonah, Daniel is the anti-Jonah, which is much better than being the Antichrist. Jonah was an Israelite. Jonah was an Israelite, and Jonah's take on it was, to hell with everyone else. I'm an Israelite, God is our God, to hell with everyone else. That's the whole point of the book of Jonah. He didn't want to go and preach to the Ninevites, but if he must, then he's going to go give the worst sermon ever recorded on paper, truly the worst sermon ever recorded, and then they actually respond to this awful sermon and give their hearts to the Lord, and he's pissed about it. He's angry about it because these are not Israelites. These are not his people. This is not his tribe, and they have no business repenting and coming to the Lord. Daniel, for his part, unlike Jonah, was kidnapped, enslaved, and castrated, as we spoke about before. Can't even say it. Horrible things. He's got no reason for any affection for these people. He's got no reason. But he actually seems to feel sorry for them and actually wants to minister to them with truth and with God's love. He pities the reigning power in the Near East at this time, the Babylonians. And he correctly perceives, as this blessing shows, Daniel correctly perceives that he, Daniel, by virtue of knowing God, is actually the one in power in this position. That Daniel actually has the power in this position, and he can actually afford to feel sorry for Nebuchadnezzar and his ilk. Because God and God alone raises up kings, and God alone tears them down, and Nebuchadnezzar wouldn't be where he was at, in a sense, without God, without even the breath in his lungs that God has given him. And Daniel stakes his life on this fact over and over again in the book of Daniel, that he just knows that he, Daniel, is the one who has the real power in the situation. Daniel really does seem to know Christ. I mean, he doesn't know Christ. He doesn't have any sense of who Jesus is or what he did or anything. But if there was a Christian person in the Old Testament, it'd be Daniel. He just seems to know that he's to turn the other cheek, to love his enemies, to forgive 70 times seven times. He just is Christ-like through the whole book. God dwells daily in Daniel's heart, and he knows it. And that gives him, to come full circle, the strength to speak truth to power. Because he knows that the real power lies with him, with Daniel, with God. So he's not really actually speaking truth to power. He's just speaking truth, which is a lot easier, I think. And the results are pretty incredible. And so I'll read the dream and the interpretation, and we'll just reflect on that, and then we'll be done. So he's bought the time, he's got the dream, the interpretation. Daniel goes back to Arioch. This executioner seems to be sympathetic to Daniel's aims. He apparently does not want, for whatever reason, to execute all the priests or whatever in the city. So Daniel goes back to the executioner whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon, said to him, "Do not destroy the wise men of Babylon." And again, emphasizing on not himself, not his friends. "Do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Bring me in before the king, and I will give the king the interpretation." Can you give me the next one there? Then Arioch quickly brought Daniel before the king and said to him, "I found among the exiles from Judah a man who can tell the king the interpretation." And the king said to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, "Are you able to tell me the dream that I have seen and its interpretation?" Now right there at the end of verse 26 is where the whole drama, you can just see his executioner, his torturer, standing in the wings with their knives and their, "Are you able to tell me?" Right there in the middle of the palace. And Daniel answered the king, "No wise men, enchanters, magicians, or diviners can show to the king the mystery that the king is asking." That's not how I would have started that sentence. "Yes," is what I would have said. But he ups the ante. He ups the tension. He says, "You know what? You really have asked an impossible thing." In a way, he's agreeing. He's, you know, taking the side of the Babylonians, the Babylonian priests. "But there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries." So he's taking the praise and the away from himself from the very beginning, that this isn't about Daniel, this is about God. There's a God in heaven who reveals mysteries, and he has disclosed to King Nebuchadnezzar what will happen at the end of days. "Your dream and the visions of your head as you lay in bed were these. To you, O king, as you lay in bed, came thoughts of what would be hereafter." Existential fear, right? I mean, we've all been like, what does the world hold? I mean, is it all just, am I just going to Sheol? Is any of this have any point, any meaning? Nebuchadnezzar had existential angst. He was a human being made in God's image. Came thoughts will be hereafter, and the revealer of mysteries disclosed to you what is to be. But as for me, this mystery has not been revealed to me because of any wisdom that I have, more than any other living being. But in order that the interpretation may be known to the king, and that you may understand the thoughts of your mind. I mean, he almost sounds like Jesus there. You know, when Jesus says, you know, this has happened in order that God's power might be revealed, even the way he talks, this has happened that for, you know, that you may understand the thoughts, you can have internal peace. This is why this is happening, so that God can give you peace. Okay. You were looking, O king, and lo, there was a great statue. The statue was huge, its brilliance extraordinary. It was standing before you, and its appearance was frightening. The head of that statue was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its middle and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. And as you looked on, a stone was cut out, not by human hands, and it struck the statue on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were all broken in pieces and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away, so that not a trace of them could be found. But the stone that struck the statue became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. That was the dream. Now we will tell the king its interpretation. You, O king, the king of kings, to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power, the might, and the glory. So he's putting Nebuchadnezzar in his place in a way, like you owe this to God. Into whose hands he has given human beings wherever they live, the wild animals of the field and the birds of the air, and whom he has established as ruler over them all, you are the head of gold. And after you, after you're gone, shall arise another kingdom inferior to yours, and yet a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over the whole earth, and there shall be a fourth kingdom strong as iron. Just as iron crushes and smashes everything, it shall crush and shatter all these. And the next one. As you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, it shall be a divided kingdom. But some of the strength of iron shall be in it, as you saw the iron mixed with the clay. As the toes of the feet were part iron and part clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly brittle. As you saw the iron mixed with clay, so will they mix with one another in marriage, but they will not hold together, just as iron does not mix with clay. And in the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed, nor shall this kingdom be left to another people. It shall crush all these kingdoms and bring them to an end, and it shall stand forever, just as you saw that a stone was cut from the mountain, not by hands, and that it crushed the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold. The great God has informed the king what shall be hereafter. The dream is certain, and its interpretation trustworthy. Boy, that's an exclamation point. He's not even backing down one iota. This is the dream. That's the interpretation. Thank you very much. Bow, exit stage left. So that's a lot. This is what God can do when we're not afraid and when we speak truth to people who are even hold, you know, our lives in our hands. To me, this is a an exhortation that makes me sort of excited even, of what we can do when we're willing to just speak to people with love. I mean, all along, Daniel's intention is not to build his own kingdom, but rather to care for Nebuchadnezzar and for the Babylonians, which is, as I keep saying, remarkable. But this is amazing to me, because this is what, and I encourage you, if you have any doubt about what I'm saying, you know, look it up online or do some research on your own. This stuff is so easy to find in this day and age to read about. So he's talking about four kingdoms. I'll just start going back and forth on the, you know, there was the Babylonian kingdom was the head of gold, right? And there came a second kingdom that was inferior to that. After the Babylons, Cyrus conquered the Babylonian Empire and created the Persian Empire, which was somewhat smaller and somewhat truncated than the Babylonian Empire. After the Persian Empire came the Greeks. Alexander the Great conquered the Near East. That was the Greek Empire. And then the fourth empire, which was the Empire of Iron, which was the strongest, would be Rome. And that is the way things unfolded. Now, what's fascinating is that according to Daniel's prophecy, I couldn't think of the word, according to his prophecy, it was under the Roman Empire, the last one of iron, that God breaks off a stone that creates a kingdom that will last forever and outlast all other kingdoms. He's prophesying about us. We are the fruit of Daniel's prophecy. Now, to me, that's, I mean, to me, that's astounding. I mean, this was definitely written. I mean, there's copies of the book of Daniel in the Dead Sea Scrolls, and it's definitely written before Christ, written before the Romans took power. There's debate within how early it was written. I believe it was written when it was said it was written, which is at the end of the Babylonian Empire. Anyway, none of that really matters, but it's definitely an old, old prophecy. So it either happened or it didn't. Either Jesus rose from the dead or he didn't. Either Daniel was completely wrong, and this is not a certain dream or a trustworthy interpretation, or under Christ, God really did establish a new empire, a new kingdom, a new heaven and earth that started with Christ and will outlast all the nations. This was written hundreds of years before any of that came to pass. I find that phenomenal. I mean, that's just an incredible... And you'll find, I mean, I'm not making this stuff up about the Persians and the Greeks and the Romans. Feel free to read the secular atheist scholars who interpret this as well. They struggle with this too, to know how he knew about the four empires that came. That's why they try to have Daniel written as late as humanly possible on the basis of this passage alone, because they can't explain it. But even so, even if it's written as late as humanly possible, the Dead Sea Scrolls definitively date it before Christ, well before Christ. There's no way Daniel could have known about the cornerstone that would become the rock of salvation, etc., etc., etc. It's just not possible. That's the power of when you're willing to risk everything for God and to come before someone and just speak truth, prophecy becomes real. I find that to be profoundly encouraging. And so I'm going to end with that. Amen. Let's pray and then we'll go to communion.